money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
We're not on yet, are we? 10:11:01.
Wouldn't that be funny if we're actually on right now?
Yeah.
I'm a little depressed that this didn't work, though.
Good morning, you beautiful bunch of fuckers, and welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. It is Tuesday, December 5th. We are here live. It's time for the Power Hour. I've got the team with me from Pittsburgh Power, Pete and Leroy, today. I think Bruce is traveling and will not be able to join us. Phone lines are open. I'm going to give you the new phone number, so grab something to write with if you need to. It is a maintenance free-for-all. If you've got a question about engines, performance, fuel mileage, modifications, upgrades, troubleshooting, emissions, you name it, we'll talk about it. All you have to do is pick up the phone and join us. That number, 319-527-6791. And we're going to go to the phones right now and hear from Pete and Leroy, and then we'll get to your calls and questions. So line them up. Today's going to go fast. We are going to limit today to 2 hours. I've just got a lot going on this week, so jump in quick, and we'll get to your call and question. 319-527-6791. Pete, Leroy, good morning, guys.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Good, now that I managed to unmute myself so people could actually hear me talking.
Good.
Yes.
We wonder what was going on.
That's one of those things you have to do. Yeah.
You have to do that. It's a talk show. People have to be able to hear me talk. Actually, I did it once, and then I did it again that people could actually hear.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell everybody this. My first attempt was my best ever. It was absolutely brilliant, and I can't believe everybody missed it.
It always works that way.
I know. What's new and exciting in your world today?
So I was just going to go over the shop. So we're getting caught up. Anything big in size we can get in on the 18th. Uh-oh. In between now and then, we can get into the small shop.
Got some guys here in the background that I don't need. Get rid of that. All right. Pete,
you there?
Leroy, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, so the shop's getting caught up. Bigger jobs, December 18th on, we can get you in. Like, small jobs, we can get in. If you got a call, we'll put them in.
Hold on. I've got to fix. There we go. All right. Something was going wrong there with somebody trying to dial out, I think. I think it's Angie. All right. We'll try again. Go ahead.
Okay. So the shop's getting caught up, and decent-sized jobs we can bring in from the 18th on, and then smaller jobs up until then, and give us a call. We have some open spots we can squeeze in for an overhead or a boost check or codes, the smaller stuff. So we're starting to get caught up a little bit in the shop finally.
Well, that's good.
Mm-hmm. And parts have been pretty good. We've had some issues with parts, not like we were having. They seem to be kind of random stuff, a little oddball.
Okay.
We can't get, but overall, it hasn't been a problem.
Yeah.
Coming along.
All right. I wish that was the case with RV shops. I had a couple little issues that I really needed to get fixed, and I didn't feel like doing it myself. I can't find anybody. Everybody is just weeks out.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, we're finally, for a while there, I mean, we were months out. But, it's this week's full. And next week I get some, open days here and there for smaller stuff. So better than what it was.
Yeah, there you go. All right, anything else going on?
That's it for me.
Leroy?
I might have funny story time. Everyone enjoys funny story time.
Of course we do. Go ahead.
So we have in the shop X15 Peterbilts, and it's equipped with three batteries. And the guy says, I guess, I don't know why I said the three battery part to start with. I'm jumping to the end of the story. Anyways, it came in because it doesn't want to start, and it has a bunch of erratic electrical issues. And the thing that we tend to start with is check the connections and check the grounds. And it's time we hear sort of erratic things where, well, the headlights don't work always, or the taillights will blink, or the engine will sometimes work. And then I get weird check engine lights. You're looking for something that is sort of attached to everything. Usually that starts with power and ground, because ground is attached to everything electrical, and so is power. So you want to kind of check there. And we started by checking the grounds, and how we do that is we measure continuity from the negative post in the battery to something metal on the cab, or one of my favorites is the metal ring on the outside of the cigarette lighter. That's a great place to check cab ground, because typically that plug itself is ran right to a metal stud that's just, usually like a self-tapper that goes right to the cab. That's usually okay. A great place to start. So anyway, we started poking around, and we had noticed that when you turn the key on, that the def light was blinking. And on these Peterbilt cabs, anytime you see the red light blinking, especially on the def gauge, some of the other gauges will do it too, but on the def gauge, when that light blinks, that means that there is no data communication from the ECM or the instrument cluster to the def system. So okay. Right off the bat, I'm like, okay, there's something weird here. We're not getting connection. Something's not powering up. And the truck won't start. And the other clue is the odometer and everything just read dashes. There's no numbers. There's no hours, no mileage, no nothing. And upon further investigation, we found that the fuse panel on the outside of the truck, meaning the one that's under the hood, only had like 6 volts going to the fuses. I'm like, 6 volts? Like on a 12-volt system, that ain't right. And yeah. I look up at the connection to it, and there's this big rusty bolt that's on it. I'm like, man, I found it. We just got to clean up that connection. It's the power to the fuse box. Well, we take it apart, clean it up, and put it back on, and it really wasn't that bad. And it's still 6 volts. Okay, now we have to keep tracing it back. We go to the next connector. It's 6 volts of that connector. And this is just sort of a general rule for, like, troubleshooting electrical things, especially, like, low voltage. You just have to keep going back until you find the source. And the source was in the battery box. And like I had mentioned, it had 3 batteries. And we go across, and we're like, okay, well, what's the battery voltage? Like, does this go to like a fuse box? Like, what is here? And we go across, and we got 12 volts in one battery, 12 volts in the next battery, and 6 volts in the third battery.
Really?
Well, there's our problem. And somebody had just put batteries in this truck.
Huh.
And
okay.
If you know how like parallel and series wiring works, when you wire the batteries in parallel, you connect each one of them with the jumper, right?
Right.
Well, one of the batteries that powered basically most of the truck didn't have the jumper to the next battery. So one battery was used to power that whole fuse box, which powers the ECM, the after treatment, the headlights, the taillights, a bunch of things, right? That entire fuse box. But because it wasn't jumped to the next one, it never would get any charge from the alternator. So they put a new battery in at 12 volts. It worked for a while, but never got recharged, and that battery just continued to drain until you got to that threshold where it would work, not work, work, not work.
So was there only one battery trying to power everything?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The one battery kind of just was powering that fuse box, and then maybe a couple of other little small things.
Okay, so like the other two that were wired to the starter.
Yeah, the other two were wired to the starter and the alternator and everything, like in the cab. Cab all came up. It was just there was a main wire that came off that one battery that went to that fuse box, and that was the one that wasn't connected.
Oh, boy. Yeah, don't you just love dealing with somebody else's mistake?
Well, in some ways it's easy because when you see new batteries put in, that's a great place to start. I mean, just in troubleshooting in general. Like, if you start having an issue, check the last place that you just touched, you know.
Yeah, or somebody else.
Because you're like, yeah, they just put a starter on, they just put batteries on it, and, you know, it's like, oh, well, what did they do?
Yeah.
But yeah, the ECM never made any noise. I mean, all these modern engines, when you turn the key on, everyone knows the thing makes some strange noises. You hear things moving, actuators dancing back and forth, a lift pump might kick on. You turn the key on and nothing would happen. And this is the other part, the other like damaging part, was somebody had done a wiring repair to like an outside air temperature sensor, but they broke the ECM connector. And the way that these connectors work is they have like a latch on them, and inside the latch is attached to a gear, and the gear slides sort of like a hooking lock mechanism. So you put the connector on, and as you turn the latch to lock it, it sort of grabs the connector and pulls itself on. It's not like you push the connector all the way on, then you push the locking tab. The locking tab is what pulls it into place. Like okay. I had an old Trans Am that had like a little electric latch where you put like the trunk down, and then you would hear a motor that would finish like sucking the trunk down in.
Right.
So it's kind of like that, but with the latch. And that was broken, so the ECM connector wasn't even on all the way. So, because I fixed the battery part, and I was like, all right, it's going to start now.
You're right.
It doesn't start. I was like, oh, boy. And then that's when we found that the ECM connectors broke, because as soon as I started wiggling it, I heard the lift pump come on. I was like, okay.
Well,
this isn't
In this story, almost everything you looked at as far as troubleshooting in order was wrong. Like the first post was really rusty. That could have caused all this. Then each time you went to look for something, then that wire off, the battery's being wired wrong. Obviously, that's a problem. That should have fixed this. So every step you did, you found a problem. But ultimately, you had to fix, possibly you had to fix all of them to get this working right. Clearly, you had to fix the battery wiring.
Yeah, and sometimes that's the trouble, like you said, with troubleshooting is you feel like you have the aha moment, and then the aha moment leads to another one. It's just like, well, that was a problem, but that wasn't the problem, you know?
Yeah, you know what this points out, though, the benefit of good troubleshooting techniques. You could have wasted a lot of time on this had you done things backwards.
Yeah, I mean... And now that you know what the solution is, you could have been like, well, why didn't you just start at the battery, you know?
Right.
There's so many entry points to the troubleshooting tree, especially if you're just doing it freehand, you know, just off the top of your head, that you can start from anywhere, and they're all going to lead you to the same place. It might have been faster just to start at the batteries, but there are some assumptions there that, oh, they just put batteries in. All the connections look clean because somebody cleaned them up. I would assume that they hooked them back up correctly. You know,
and just glancing at it, you'd never know. You've got to follow the cables around. And if you look at it, you just assume people ran the cables correctly.
Yeah. And this, like, the cable that was off was really hard to see because it was just buried under like loom and zip ties. And it was, I don't fault the guy for missing it. It wasn't like plain as day, but.
Yeah.
It was definitely off. And then that proceeded to kill all the rest of the batteries, because when you hook a 6-volt battery up to the 12-volt, the 12-volt batteries will try to charge the 6-volt, so then they all become equal. So then it just drained all the batteries, and now it's just sitting out there, and the batteries are just dead as can be. And that was one of the things I was showing with the new guy. I was like, the amp gauge in the truck, when it's buried at like 110 amps, or what are the alternators typically rated at, like 110, 140 amps or something like that on a truck? Is that what they're usually at?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. I know I've seen 200 and 300, like off ambulance, and people who use them if they've got a big power draw. We had to do something like that when we tried testing the hydrogen. We just couldn't get enough amperage out of the alternator. But I think the standard is somewhere between 100 and 200. I'm just not sure.
Yeah, so it was somewhere in there. And I'm like, you see the amp gauge on the dash? I was telling the new guy this. I was like, when that thing
right.
is, that means that the alternator is doing everything it can. It's giving all the chooch, all the steam to try to, like, bring these batteries back to life. Like, those batteries are very dead. It's taking a lot of current to charge them.
And that's the thing to remember. There's nothing on the truck itself that would ever pull that kind of power. The only thing that pulls that kind of power is trying to charge the batteries.
Well, yeah. And plus, like, if you have engine off and key on and, like, you turn, like, your, I don't know, like some sort of 10-amp draw, it's going to go
right.
in the other direction. It's going to go negative. So
right.
when the needle was on the other side of the map, that means it's trying to charge 75 amps. It's not drawing. It's, like, trying to charge.
Yeah.
So, it typically takes like an hour, seems like, to fully, an hour, hour and a half to fully charge batteries from dead like that. So we either put it on a battery charger, which is the less fuel or the more fuel efficient way to charge batteries. But it's kind of a mess out there.
Yeah, I had one of those weird electrical issues yesterday. My macerator pump went out. And it's buried down in the plumbing bay. It's hard to get to. It's hard to just get it out. There's only two bolts with nuts on them, but trying to get to them was a total nightmare. So I was in there, I don't know, probably a good hour and a half just to get it out. And as soon as I got it out, just for the fun of it, it was still wired and everything was connected. As soon as I got it out, I hit the switch and it worked. Now... need another hour and a half to put it back in. It may have just been a loose connector, but I couldn't even find the connector. I mean, I couldn't see where the wires ran to. I couldn't feel it back there until I got the whole pump out. As soon as I got the pump out, it worked. It was probably just a loose connection that reconnected. So I'm just going to go through and check everything and put the stupid thing back in again. I also
put it back in and doesn't work. That's when it's really bad. Like, I just thought you worked.
Well, this time I'm at least going to run the wire so I can see the final connector before the pump, because really what I wanted to do before I took it out, I wanted to check to see if I had power there. I knew I had power at the switch, and then the next connector is right by the pump itself, and I just wanted to see if I had power there, because if I did, then it's just a bad pump. And the pump's only 2 years old, so I didn't really think it should have been the pump, but... this time I'll make sure I run the wires so that I can get to the connector without taking the pump off.
Yeah.
So I can at least check
power.
Then I have the ongoing saga of my indestructible Starlink satellite dish. This
okay.
thing has dropped out the window onto gravel, so that's probably a 8 or 9 foot drop. I dropped it off pulled it off the top of the coach. Putting one of my slides out, that's about a 13-foot drop, and it landed in gravel. And I drug it through the parking lot once. That was a stupid mistake. And it, after all that, it finally just quit working one day. And I couldn't get a new one, and I thought, you know what? With the way I've abused this thing, obviously they're not going to cover any of this under warranty. So what would it hurt to try to tear this thing apart and see what I can find? And tearing it apart is the right word. I had to destroy the cover on this thing to get it off. I'm sure there's some process of using a heat gun or a heat knife or something, but I didn't have any of that, and I thought, I'm just going to tear it apart. So I tore the cover off. It ended up in 100 pieces, and I actually found two loose connectors in there. I connected them, and it worked again. So then I decided I need to recover this thing somehow, or it's going to get moisture inside. And I didn't get to it because I've been really busy. And the next morning we were supposed to get a rainstorm. So I was going to get up early and take it off there and bring it inside and try to waterproof it. The rainstorm showed up about 6 hours early. And I woke up and it was just pouring rain and zero signal on the satellite. And I thought, all right, I just fried it this time. So after it stopped raining, I brought it in, dried it out, stuck it back up there, and it's working again.
This is going to be one of those ones where it's indestructible until you, like, drop it off of a stool, and then it never works again. It's like, doesn't survive, like, a 2-foot fall.
Yeah, I have just abused this thing, and it just keeps working.
Yeah.
That's a good product.
It is. It is. The whole service. I can't say enough about it. It's the best internet service I've ever had.
I mean, that would be a great ad. Maybe you can get some, like, advertising dollars. Just have, like, a clip of you, like, dragging it behind the RV, like, through a gravel parking lot. And be like, it still works.
Every time I post about it with pictures and everything, I always tag Elon Musk. He hasn't responded to me yet, though.
Hmm. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. As soon as he does, I'm going to hit him up with that idea, though.
Yeah, but like I got a great advertising clip. He might go for it. You never know.
He might. As soon as I can get his attention. He only has like, I don't know, 40 million followers or something. He should see my message sooner or later.
Yeah, but you're Kevin Rutherford, though, you know.
It's true.
Like, that's, you got to be at least top 10 on his like top friends list.
It's got to count for something.
I think so.
All right. Hey, I just looked at the board. We've got an awful lot of phone calls. People want to talk to you guys.
They want to talk to Pete. How about me?
We're ready. We're ready.
All right. Let's do it. Let's get started in Ohio. Les, welcome.
Hey, I've What's got a question. I got a question on a Cummins big can that's in our Case IH tractor.
Okay. Hey, Leroy, you were right. It is for Pete.
Yep. No, they don't want to talk to me.
It's, at 2,500 hours, we cracked a number two piston. And now, so we replaced one hole, and now at 4,600 hours, it scored number three and cracked number one and number two. So what would, this time here, I think the reason it scored was, I think an injector must have stuck and washed a cylinder down. But why would one and six crack, and this is only a 335 horse 855.
Okay. So the cracks, are they on top of the pistons? Is that where they're at?
They're on top, right where the piston is machined out for like where the valve.
Generally, they can crack from heat and pressure. Do you have a pyrometer in the tractor?
No.
Okay. So that'd be a good place to start. Let's see what kind of heat we're making. if everything's right, it shouldn't be making heat, but there is some issues, then and the pyrometer is getting hot, that can, those heat cracks can occur from high pyrometer temperature.
Okay. I mean, usually when it's operating RPM-wise, we're, I mean, we're higher than a truck would be. We're 1,800 to 2,200 RPM range. And the only difference is, what are the difference between a three-ring piston and a four-ring piston? When we, the one we replaced, at when it cracked the first time, we put a three-ring in. And they look like they're a lot heavier duty on the top of the piston. Should that be what we should go to when we overhaul it here now?
So the three-ring piston is the only thing available from Cummins. Cummins went from the four-ring to a three-ring probably 20-some years ago. So if you found a four-ring piston, it's old stock.
Well, this engine's a 1990. It was made in October of 90.
Would might have been three-ring back or four-ring back then. But if you buy new cylinder kits, they'll all be three-ring. So Cummins redesigned the piston to reduce friction, was one of the reasons. It reduced cost. There's one less ring in the pack. There's one less machining on the piston needing to be done. So Cummins went to three-ring, and it's fine. And we've not had any problems with a three-ring piston.
Okay, so this is a CPL 1255. Should we, when we overhaul it, is there a CPL that's better or that's just fine? We just have bad luck? Or?
So, I mean, I don't see, we do some work on equipment. I do most of it on trucks, and these engines are pretty similar. Let me see this 1255.
Yeah, I was
gonna
say,
going on
Pete's
there.
Got his own tablets out.
Yep. Or, got the old manuals out. Okay, so it's got the 14-to-1 piston, so it's got good compression ratio pistons. It's timed if it's the 350. So the pistons are the right pistons that go in there. The only thing I would do is probably slow the timing down, but changing timing is somewhat of a big job. To slow the timing down far enough, we have to pull the cam out, put a different key in there, and then retime it. And that's
you
a lot
of work. You would retard it?
Yes. Yeah, we retard timing to reduce cylinder pressure. And keep in mind, on a truck, they're almost never at full horsepower, where you're going to be in it quite a bit.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, like you say, it's only got, it's got 4,600 hours on it right now. And I mean, everything, the rod bearings look good. Everything cam looks good. It's just, I just figured maybe these pistons were, like you say, they're just faulty. Or this time here, at least we caught it. The first time it cracked and went through the exhaust valve and into the turbo. This time here, when it scored number three, we can just see they're cracked. They really haven't come apart yet.
Yeah, they normally don't come apart. That's pretty uncommon for that to happen.
Are they all stock injectors? Or do the injectors change?
Yeah, it's stock. I mean, it's from Case IH, as far as we know, it's pump seals never been cut or anything like that.
I mean, you got like hot cylinders, cylinders getting wiped out.
Now, the scoring
just got wiped down. Something happened to the injector this last time. It looks good on the outside. I don't see no tip or nothing broke, but all the holes were just full of diesel fuel.
So anytime you pull a head off, that's not uncommon. So what happens is when you take your rocker box off and you take the load off the injectors, any fuel that's in the cylinder head, and there's a fuel route through there, it will drip into the piston. So it's not uncommon to see fuel on top of a piston when you remove a cylinder head. So that's pretty much normal.
On everything.
Yeah.
So don't be concerned about that aspect. So as far as the liner being scored, sometimes a piston coolant nozzle either breaking off or getting plugged can cause a liner to score. Oil squirts up on the piston to keep it cool. When that breaks,
right,
it gets hot and starts to grab the liner and then scores the liner.
Things expand and then they don't fit.
Yeah. So you want to make sure the piston coolant nozzles are good.
Okay. Because I had a truck one time where the piston cooling nozzle broke off and it lost oil pressure.
So it depends on where they break. So the hole is pretty small, but if they break off towards the back, the hole is now much larger. And the loop pump sometimes can't keep up and pressure. So sometimes there's a warning. In your case, the first time there was, you had low oil pressure, you knew something was up. Or if some debris went through it and simply plugged the tip up, you wouldn't get oil
right in
that piston. That's a possibility.
I mean, they're pretty easy to change. I guess we probably should just change them all.
Yep. I put all six new ones in.
Yeah, because you're getting hot cylinders. That's why, you know, things are breaking, things are scoring. So
but definitely,
are they hot because of the timing? Are they hot because the injectors are leaking, you know, or the two, whatever, I don't know.
So, I mean, it's for a 350 horse engine with lower compression pistons, and they generally do that in equipment. So I don't think there's anything wrong with this setup, especially if you're going to keep it fairly stock. I'd definitely get a pyrometer. Let's see once it's built how hot the engine's getting in case there's an issue. Did you check the turbo, see if it was damaged and or replace the turbo?
Yeah, I lost you there for a second. What?
So the last time when you had that failure through the cylinder head and out the turbo, did it damage the turbocharger?
Yeah, we had to put a new turbo on it then.
You did replace it. Okay, good.
Yeah. Yeah, it locked it clear up.
Okay. Because I've had debris damage the exhaust wheel. People don't check for that. And then they, of course, have high pyrometer temperature because of the turbine wheel being damaged. But you don't know that because you don't have a gauge in there. But I'd still get a gauge on it. Rebuild it back to what it is and throw a gauge on there. Pyrometer gauge and see where you're at.
Okay. So you would keep with this just the stock Cummins pistons. If we just get where would be the best place to get a good reman or get good aftermarket parts?
Good aftermarket isn't the case. I mean, I would use genuine Cummins, and we keep them in stock.
Okay.
A lot of pistons. I'd have to research this out, and you can call me after the show, and I verify that I have a set, but I should have a set for this.
Okay. That's all I had today. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's move along. We're going to head off to Texas this time. Lyle, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I lost my old truck, and it was going to cost more to repair it than to buy another one, so I have purchased a 2015 Volvo with 264 rears and the D13 with a lifetime fuel average of 7.9 based on total fuel used in the ECM and miles.
Okay.
I pull an open step deck, triple axle, do a lot of oversized stuff. So I got some questions about this engine. I don't know much about them other than what I've listened to you guys talk. So should the dampener be replaced? I have one issue that I've got that I'm wondering.
Oversized, not overweight, right?
More just oversized instead of weight.
Okay.
It's not at 455 horsepower at this point.
The damper on the Volvo is internal, and I don't know anybody that's replacing them. Pete, have you heard anything different on this?
I have not. As far as I know, they're not replacing them because of it'd be a big expensive job to do.
Right. And the other thing I will tell you is for whatever reason, we haven't seen the kind of problems you see in other engines when you don't replace the damper. So we're not seeing clutch or transmission issues or, you know, alternator coming loose and right. So for whatever reason, that doesn't seem to be an important issue at all on that engine.
Okay. Point, I've had 12 fuel ups. I'm sitting at 6.4, I believe. That's somewhere around 55 cents cost per mile. What can I do to help improve this? I'm going to put air tabs on it.
How many miles?
What else can you do this engine? 920 is when I purchased it.
920. Have you done overhead?
I have not. I wondered about that.
Yeah, I would definitely do an overhead. Make sure you use a good Volvo shop that knows how. I know that seems like a really basic thing, but we see it done wrong a lot. I believe this is the engine that might, maybe not. My concern right now is why the fuel mileage is so off the average. I mean, you're down a mile per gallon. Most of these trucks today, and you know, after 2010 or so, the fuel mileage numbers on these get pretty accurate. Unless something goes wrong, we've got a sensor way out of whack, or most of the time these new trucks are fairly accurate.
So,
you're whatever happened while you got really noisy.
So, a couple there things. One is, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Go ahead. A couple things that I would check. I would set the overhead. Has anybody tested the charger cooler since you've had it?
No, it does build 36 pounds of boost. I know that.
That's
digital.
Yeah, it doesn't tell us anything. I mean, we could still have a boost leak and not know it. On the oil in this truck.
The oil is in fresh oil. Looks good. I have not sent a sample in, but I'm going to do that.
Yeah, you really need to wait till almost 15,000 to 20,000 miles before we're going to see anything. But those are the three things I would recommend to see if we can track down why the fuel mileage isn't what it's supposed to be, and then we could start modifying. I don't like to start modifying things until we get all of the maintenance done, everything's been checked, and we know it's right, because if you start modifying, you can cover up the problems that are there. It will start to get better fuel economy. It'll go up. We'll think everything's right. So the first step is always make sure everything that's there is working the way it's supposed to.
Okay. So a couple of things I do know about it is when I picked it up, I drove it bobtail home. I drove it 63 miles an hour, and I averaged 7.8. As soon as I hooked the trailer on, the fuel mileage dropped like a rock.
Well, it should. I mean, I've had trucks get 14 miles to the gallon bobtailing. Joel's probably been up over 15 at times bobtailing. So we expect that. And that's going to drop significantly when you put a trailer on it. No doubt about it. That's exactly what we would expect. But both numbers that you're telling me are much lower than I would expect to see out of this truck right now. The bobtail number at 7.8 is not good at all. I mean, isn't even matching the lifetime fuel mileage of this truck pulling freight around.
Exactly. That just blew my mind on that.
Yeah. So,
I've got one issue that I'm curious about on this truck, and that is under power, it vibrates the entire truck. It's not a what I would call a deep vibration. It's more like a buzz, if that makes sense. What would cause that?
Oh, boy. Vibrations could be all over the place. I mean, we could go back to the damper, but I don't think that's the case. And the damper usually doesn't create what you're describing, a high frequency vibration. We can describe vibrations by frequency, how often it happens. A buzz is a fast, high frequency vibration. Most likely it's driveline. But you can start to troubleshoot this yourself a little bit. You said it's only under power you feel it?
Right. As soon as you let off the gas, well, it smooths out. It disappears.
Then that's less likely to be driveline, and it is more likely to be something in the engine itself. Loose motor mounts, maybe. Pete, any other thoughts on a high frequency vibration only under power?
So one thing I would rule out would be getting air into the fuel with a sight glass. So sometimes air in the fuel can make it feel like it's got a vibration. It's just easy to rule out. When you do that test, hey, it's good. I don't have to look there anymore. Let's, you know, move on to something else. So I would, like you said, get the overhead set, take an oil sample, check for a boost leak, and have them check for sucking air, because that can affect fuel mileage as well.
And we can't. Yeah, that's a good point. That may be the an issue for both of these things. That makes sense. You know, I said it's probably not driveline, but we can't rule it out. I've seen some U-joints that would only do that under power, and when they coast, you don't feel it. But I would move driveline down the list, and I think I'd focus on engine right now. And that the sight glass is a great place to start.
With that amount of miles on the driveline, you know, not out of the ordinary for it to have a problem with it. I mean, it should probably be checked.
Right.
Like you said, the carrier bearings, make sure they're good. Make sure the U-joints are good. Probably should have the drive shaft straightened and balanced at that point as well.
Okay. And do they have, like, polished exhaust for these trucks, by any chance?
No.
No, okay.
Unfortunately, we really don't have much for the Volvo.
You mean a manifold?
Yes. All right. So, I was wondering, the reason I'm in this truck is because of my old truck, but I was wondering if I could ask a couple of questions about that. That truck was a Signature Series Cummins 600 ISX.
Sure.
The oil pump in March lunched, and obviously the oil from the air pump is used by the engine or comes from the engine. And when that lunched, it put trash in the engine and got the head and bearings and everything else. Is there, how do you determine whether you could actually ever use that engine or not? I mean, it evidently plugged the oil passages to the head and it ruined the cam. And this was a new engine purchased a year and a half ago, didn't have 110,000 miles on it. It was a block with the head included, with the engine, pistons all included with it when I put it in the truck.
And
then we just added the accessories.
What, the air compressor fail or the fuel pump?
The air compressor.
Air compressor. Okay. So, I mean, that happens, and they will put – the oil goes from the engine through the air compressor and, of course, drains back into the pan. So if you do have a failure with the air compressor, you can get – pieces into the oil. Now, generally, it goes from the pan to the loop pump to the filter, so the filter really should have caught most of that. I'm surprised that much got through the filter.
Okay, so my first clue was oil pressure went down to 22. And I said, well, we need to...
under load?
That's under load, or just driving down the road at 65.
Yeah. Yeah, that's low. That's definitely low.
And so when we pulled the valve cover off, the camshaft was destroyed. and the bearings, rod bearings had wear in them, a lot of wear in them, even though it doesn't even have 100,000 on the engine. So,
did you spin any bearings? I mean, the main bearing or rod bearing, none of them spun?
Best that we could tell, they did not.
Okay. So if that's the case, then the block and crank's still usable. And basically, when we would run into an issue like, we would just flush out the oil system with solvent.
Okay.
Once we got everything tore apart. And replace the oil cooler. Probably the loop up needs replaced. Anything oil related could have fouled. The turbocharger, the aircraft, all that would need replaced. But I don't see why the block and crank would not be usable again.
Oh, you need to replace the turbocharger as well?
Yeah, so if the debris went through the engine and damaged it, it's definitely going to affect the turbo because the turbo has oil going through it. And with the heat and speed, they're pretty sensitive to dirty oil. So I wouldn't take a chance with the turbo with a failure like that.
Oh, I see. Okay. And what about the head? How do you determine whether a head is, you just have to pull it up and have a mic or
well,
whatever?
A machine shop, and they would inspect it and see if they would check it for flatness, for cracks, and magnaflex it, mic all the valves, see if everything's in spec, and go from there. With the low mileage,
coming,
I think the heads would be usable.
Right. Has Cummins changed that as far as the oil going to the air pump?
No. All engines, Cat, Cummins, Detroit, get oil, you know, from the engine to the air compressor, and then, you know, drains back into the block.
Okay. So possibly the engine could be salvageable to rebuild.
Yeah, as long as you don't have a spun bearing, I would certainly think so.
Okay. I appreciate it. That's what I had today.
All right. Let's go to Alabama. Bill, welcome to the program.
How y'all doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Just got a quick question, and then I will get off. Hey, I got an X15, and what would you guys suggest changing out the, because I'm hearing like different numbers, changing out the OPS and the oil filter on the engine?
I'd like 25,000 on the OPS and sample there, and then 50,000 on the full flow filters.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, that was quick enough. All right, I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Minnesota. Richard, welcome.
Hey, guys. I got a couple questions, pretty quick questions. One, running an overhead, do I have to, on a 12.7 Detroit 99 model, do I have to take the J8 brakes off to do the overhead?
You do not, just the valve cover.
Okay. On injectors, I've been having real bad high fuel dilution on this engine ever since I've got it. I changed the injectors on my first oil sample, and it seemed to do better, but then it went right back up. I've been trying to find somebody that can test them, and I found a company in Jacksonville called Diesel Logics that can, they say that they rebuild the injectors and they bench test them to make sure that they're not leaking and all that stuff. Is that something that can be done, actually be done, or do y'all do that, such things, or not?
So we don't do electronic injectors here, but there are shops that have the equipment to do it. And fuel dilution on a 12.7 is pretty common. I guess it would depend on how high it is and what mileage intervals. If it's 2 or 3% at 25,000 miles, it's going to be impossible to find. We just can't find it. You're at 10% at 15,000 miles, the chance of finding it's a whole lot better. We see a lot of fuel dilution issues in 12.7s.
Yeah. Mine, let me pull it up here real quick. Mine has been in the high fours, and let me see if I'm pulling it up right now. My first sample was January 23 or this year, 5.3 and goes down from there. 5.3, 3.7, 4.6, 4.8, and 4.4 was my last one.
And how many miles were on the oil at each time?
These were start the first one. Lube time was 14,000, 20,000, 19,000, 23,000, and 23,000.
So nothing crazy.
I normally like to try to sample at around about 20,000, mm-hmm. and then when I get my sample back, that determines whether or not if I'm going to change it or not. And so normally I'll change it anywhere from 23 to 25,000.
Okay. So when you're up in the 5% range, it should be a little easier to find. I mean, a couple methods. One, you take the valve cover off and you dump dye in the fuel and you run the truck. You shine a black light over the valve train and see if you can isolate which injector is causing it. If all of a sudden all the oil starts to glow like in a fluorescent color, then we know it's the lube pump because it's leaking. I'm sorry, the fuel pump. It would be leaking fuel from the fuel pump right into the oil, and then you'd see it everywhere. If it's an injector, you'll just see it at that one injector or two injectors, depending on how many are bad. It's definitely
okay.
A 12-7 issue.
All right. So do y'all sell that dye?
Yeah, we have it. I mean, most shops do, and any local shop should handle it stuff. But you do need a black light to run over the valve train. So you got to have a black light for this to work.
Okay, and I just put that into the fuel filter, where the fuel filter's at.
So what we do is we will dump a bottle into 5 gallons of fuel and then make a hose from the pump to the 5 gallons of fuel, just a separate
amount
of fuel, and then fire the truck up with the valve covers off and, you know, just keep shining the black light over it to see which injector is doing it.
Okay. All right. And I think that's all I needed for right now, then.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. Hey, I don't get to do this often, but we have breaking news.
What's that?
As of 8:04 Pacific time this morning, Lisa and I are grandparents again. We have a new granddaughter.
Yay. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Yeah, Hannah Grace. All right. That's exciting. Now I need to get home.
Yeah, for sure. Where are you at now?
Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay. You got to have a cruise.
Yeah, I do. I'll be here till Friday. I'll take off Saturday morning. And on Tuesday, I've got a speaking engagement in Boise. So I got to kind of get there fairly quick. And then once I'm done with that, I'm only about 8 hours from home. So
that'd be good.
Soon. Yes. I need it. Yeah. Back to the gorge.
You know, this gentleman was talking about the oil analysis with the fuel in it. While Eric was off over the holidays, I was doing the oil samples. So if Polaris Lab flags an oil sample, they send it to us and we call the customer as a service to give them a heads up.
Yeah.
And what I was shocked at, how many of them had dirt injected. There was quite a few. And I know last week on the show, you read an oil analysis and the silicon was high on it.
Really high, too. If I remember right, the one in the air was like 30-something, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
It was funny. I didn't think about it that much. I'm thinking, oh, these samples, I don't normally read them for Eric usually handles that, but he was off. So I'm like, yeah, it seems like a lot. That's kind of weird. But we see things in cycles. Didn't think much about it until Eric mentioned to me when he started doing it again, he was getting a lot with high silicon. So we're, you know, this time of year, I mean, I don't think they're using much salt yet. We've only been salted here once or twice. Maybe out west they're using a lot more salt.
I don't really ever see that.
Though, right?
When we see a lot of chemicals in the wintertime, we tend to see either potassium or sodium by itself. And both can show up, and that's because some of the chemicals we put on the road are either sodium-based or potassium-based. So that makes sense. And when we see just one, we know it's not coolant, and that happens more in the wintertime. But I can't think of a single reason to see a rash of dirt in engines.
No. But we're seeing it. Like I said, I would call each day, you know, I'd get a couple calls, or I might email a couple guys that were flagged, and I was surprised. Now, nothing crazy high. Yeah, I always have them check the intake piping, the air filter, you know, stuff. but higher than what, it, like you said, it shouldn't be anything.
Have we identified a certain engine or truck?
It's been in that case, it's random. You know, like oil in the fuel, we pretty much guess it's a 12.7.
Yeah.
We see that all the time. If we're low on base, I generally see that in the DD platforms. Case it was random engines.
We're actually seeing low base on a lot of samples now. It's become a really, really common thing.
And it was, you know, a year or two ago, it seemed to be only on the Detroit DD15s and 13s. Now it seems to be on, I'm seeing them on ISXs more frequently than what I did before.
So I think one of two things needs to happen. Either the manufacturers need to put more base in the oil because we're running extended drains now on almost everything, or the labs need to check to make sure their range is correct now.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like something has changed.
And I haven't seen a pattern where it's just, it's only Shell Rotella or only Delvac. Seeing any correlation to a brand of oil. It's across the board.
Most of them start off with about the same amount of base. And one of the things I should probably check is, has that number dropped with all these new oils? Are they just not putting as much base in as they used to? It doesn't make sense that these engines are using more base. They should be using less. They're well-tuned. They're running good. We should be seeing less base used. So I'm almost wondering if they're just not putting as much in.
It's possible. And then you're right. The older engines of, they didn't have the timing controls and the metering of fuel
right.
They have now. It's so precise. I'm surprised we didn't see that years ago. I never
right.
thought about mentioning that. And we did not have a base issue with the old engines. That almost never existed.
It was, the times we would see it is on those engines where people were going 150, 200 plus thousand miles on the same oil, and then you will eventually wear out that base and you add to it. But we're seeing these things got 50 or 60,000 miles on the oil at best, and the base is almost gone.
I'm seeing it, you know, not gone, but dropping even before the recommended oil change from the factory.
Right. Right. That's what I mean. Something needs adjusted in the system, I think.
Yeah. Now, fortunately, that's an easy fix with the TBN additive.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's why I don't get too excited about it. It's easy to fix.
Yeah. It's not so expensive.
I'm much more concerned about this dirt.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to figure that one out because that just seems to be new and there's just no good reason for that I can think of. I was thinking if it's a certain model of truck or engine we're seeing it on, maybe their air filter just isn't all that great.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's random.
To see if we've got one of these trucks that consistently shows up with high dirt, what would happen if we put a Fleet air filter in it?
Yeah, and that's something I need to, you know, we don't see that on the oil sample, whether it has a Fleet air or not. I probably should ask
right.
people that.
And if they don't, it would be interesting to see what would happen if they had one.
Mm-hmm. And making sure they're cleaning it properly, too, if they do have one.
Yeah. If it goes away, it would just be a poor design of their air filter.
Okay. It's a simple fix.
Yeah. All right. We are down to our final call. I am I'm fine wrapping this up today if we're out of calls. But if you want to join us, 319-527-6791. Let's go to Texas. TJ, welcome.
Hey, what's happening, Kevin?
Starlink saga.
Yeah, I love that story. I'm going to get into that in a minute, but first I'd like to congratulate you on it. That's awesome.
Yeah, it is. We've been waiting patiently, so it's pretty exciting. I wish I was there, though.
Yeah, that's exciting. I've seen three of them live and in person right up front, the front row. I had the front row seat to three of them.
There you go.
But, yeah, that Starlink, so it's very, very durable. And the reason I know that is because I flat-mounted mine. So I did the garage flat, did it in my garage, and I cut it down. And then what you have to do is you have to get a Star Mount systems flat mount kit, So basically, have you seen this Star Mount company?
Is
have you
that
looked
the
at
one that, is that the one that's got its own built-in battery?
Well, no, not that one. This is the one from the off-road racer, the Baja racer named Brandon. And he, you know, during their racing down in Mexico, he thought, well, I'd love to, you know, live stream my races.
Yeah.
So him and some buddies, they designed a way to flat mount it inside the spare tire on top of the off-road vehicle.
Okay.
Okay, so then, and they were so successful, and they realized these Starlinks, they work on, just flat mounted. They don't even need the motor inside there that rotates it to catch the satellite. The satellites are so far away that the mount that thing moves, it doesn't affect anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whatsoever. So what you do is you get rid of the stand, you cut it down to 1 inch thick with your Dremel, right? And the kit, when you get the Star Mount Systems kit, it comes with all the measuring devices. It's basically a black electric tape roll and a marker, and you lay it face down, you know, with the front side down on the table, and then you just trace around it with a marker and the black electrical tape, and it just kind of scoots around it, gives you your line, and then you cut that out. You cut the whole stand right off, and the motor comes off. And then you're looking inside of it at the backside of the panel. And this is where I thought I got too close to something, and I thought I hurt something, but turns out I wasn't even close to damaging it when I did it. So anyway, so then you put it inside the Star Mount Systems kit, the little polyurethane compartment, and then it's 1 inch thick, and it's the same size as the dishy, right? It's like, whatever, 2 foot wide by 3 foot long, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And then you replumb the wires, and you basically use sticky tape to stick it to the, you know, so it's not flopping around in there. You stick it to the Star Mount system.
Okay.
And then you put it back together, and then around the top of it, there's a bunch of screws, and you just screw them all in, and it's got a plastic clear cover. So then, now you can put it anywhere. And you can just lay it on the top of it. You could lay it out on the ground, or you could lay it on top of your picnic table, or you can lay it on top of the coach. What I chose to do is I 3M taped it to the top of my coach.
And that's a good idea.
You know, and then I just don't worry about, like, if I can't park in a place where that thing works, then I didn't need to use the satellite anyways. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can't do that, though. I've got the show it's harder than you might think to find a wide open space to park every time.
Yeah, maybe it's because I do a lot in the Midwest, like, you know, Boise, South Dakota, Wyoming, Canada. Canada, I guess, you can get into some trees. But Tennessee, there is a lot of trees, I suppose. So, anyways, that thing surprises me every time, though, so, you know, as far as parking it.
I would have thought this thing was far more sensitive than it is. Now, I wish I would have had this advice before I decided to destroy mine, because mine has no front cover on it now, no top cover.
So here's the deal.
If I would have cut out the back, I still would have been able to get to those connectors that were loose, because I did have to tear it apart to get it working once, and I didn't think about cutting into the back. I started to remove the cover, and at some point it just started breaking apart, and I just decided, well, this thing's probably never going to work again anyway, and I'm sure I don't have any warranty on it, so I just tore the whole cover off. And like the first three layers under there, I didn't even put those back on. I think the top couple of layers might be the heating grid, because it's got that heating mode, because I didn't even put three layers of this stuff back on, and everything still works fine, but it's not waterproof. So I need to figure out a new top cover and then waterproof it.
So that was my idea. I'm like, if this thing's banged up, destroyed, the Star Mount system, that thing comes with the cover and it comes with the bottom. You can basically
Oh, so it does have a top cover.
Yeah, it comes with a top cover and a bottom cover. So you can basically take the guts out of it, throw it into the star mount, and then just zip it together because it screws to itself. So the star mount systems, all those screws, they go around the edge, and you would just – yours would be kind of cool. It'd be like you'd be able to look through the clear top and see all the interior parts of it.
Yeah,
that's your solution. I think it's $200 or $300 or $400, whatever it is. It's worth every penny. Because you could literally cut the back off of yours, put the guts into this one-inch thick thing, and you'd be all set.
Now, there is another one somebody sent me that was kind of interesting, but it's really expensive. It's like $2,400. So you can either send this company the Starlink dish you already have, and they'll build it out of yours, or you can just order one from them. I think that adds like $600 if you order it through them. But mount theirs into this box, and it is flat-mounted. Like you said, the motors all go away. There's no stand anymore. It's mounted into this box. But this box also has all of its own connections, and I think there's a router in there, if I remember right. But it's even got its own power supply. It's got its own backup, or it's got its own battery. So, like, I could just go stand out in a field with this thing in my laptop, and the battery runs the Starlink for, like, 10 hours. So you could be anywhere. You don't even need power, and you could run this thing. But I just don't think I want to spend that much money. I don't think I'd use that feature all that often.
After doing this with StarMount and Brandon, he's an entrepreneur. He answers his cell phone when you call. He'll walk you through everything.
Nice.
I wouldn't go. He's one of he provided the best service. I mean, I just did this on my own with no help but calling StarMount and talking to Brandon, the owner. Like he's really helpful. So for $300 or whatever it is, this'll work. And then you can also do what I did, which was change the cats. Say again?
That's cheaper than me getting a new dish.
Oh yeah. No, and I would, and like I said, they're bulletproof. So this is the way I would go, and I would, I would change it to the ends on the core, on the OEM Starlink cores. The ends are very, very fragile. So
if you
chop those ends off and just put Cat 6 ends on it, and then you can unplug and plug it wherever you want. You could build your own cord, one for this area and one for the top of the coach. So I have two cords. I have one that is routed and plumbed through the ceiling, right, and watertight. So you can't just take that out. If I did want to throw my Starlink off on the picnic table, I wouldn't be able to, except that when I ruined one cable, I kept it. But then I realized I can just turn these into Cat 6 plugs, connectors, like you'd plug your phone in the wall. You know, old school, they're Cat 6. Huh?
How did you figure that out, that you could just convert this to Cat 6?
Brandon at StarMount Systems.
Is that right?
He was a badass. Yeah, he's like, no. I was freaking out. I said, do I need to? Okay. I said, okay, I screwed this up. What do I got to do, buy a new Starlink? And he said, no, just convert it to Cat 6 and do this and that. And then I accidentally ordered the wrong piece because he's got two pieces that the second one is for convenience. The first one is what you need. But there's a second piece that's more for convenience. So I can move mine from the 3M tape. I don't have to destroy my 3M tape. I can take mine off the top of the coach with two screws. So that's an additional $200 or $300. So if you want to spend $300, you'll be in business. If you want to spend $600, you'll be in better business. But either way, I swear by that guy.
I love the idea of two cables. So if I'm out in the open, I can just leave it up on top, and if I need to, I can take it off and put it out in the field somewhere.
Exactly.
I think we should all say this together. Is everybody ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, we're gonna say, "Let's go, Brandon."
One, two, three. Let's go, Brandon.
There we go.
So.
By the way, I
got to apologize to your call screener because she heard me cussing on the other end of the phone when I couldn't hear her. So, and the reason that I cuss is the same reason I sing the song "Let's Go Brandon" whenever I'm mad. I don't really, I'm not really cussing. I'm just cussing to myself so that I can get it out there. But the hope is that no one's listening to me. So anyways, you got to see my second personality today, and that was fun.
Yeah, I'll bet. I'll bet Angie enjoyed it.
Yeah, but I apologize. It won't happen again.
Well, that's awesome news. Now I just need to find the time. Well, I'll probably wait till I get back on this. But I am
Don't
definitely...
Don't make me drop ship you one. I'll drop ship you one faster than Let's Truck can send me my cardio miracle.
You would have to get it here. Well, I need time to work on it. You'd have to get it here tomorrow. Because on Thursday...
I'll send it to my sister in Boise and have her husband install it. He's very techie, and he watched me do this.
Now, that would be awesome. Yeah, that would be perfect. I'll be in Boise for a day or two, so we'll see. But this is a great tip. I kept thinking this dish is just toast. You know, this thing is going to stop working any day now, and I'm going to have to get a new one. And getting a new one isn't even easy. Like, the dish is attached to the account. So you can't just go order a new dish.
Yep, you got to change everything. You got to change all your information.
Yeah, but now that I know that as long as the guts are working on this thing, you can do just about anything with it, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, if I bought a truck and it used to have like an England truck or a big mega carrier truck, if I ended up with one of these trucks that has the satellite mount attached, you know what I'm talking about? They take the Qualcomm away, but they leave the mounting bracket up there. I'd put a Starlink on there. I'd just put a Starlink right there.
It would work. By far the best internet solution I've found, even at home and mobile. Nothing else even comes close. I did see they're like bringing out their Gen 3 router. That thing looks like a UFO. Looks pretty high tech.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a great product. And like I use mine, my coach is parked on one end of the house, and then my other internet was out the other end of the house. So I have like high-speed internet on both ends of the house without having to use one of those, you know, repeaters or whatever they're called.
Yeah,
part of the new
router is it comes already ready for what they call mesh. Mesh is where you can add the extenders and get your internet out as far as you want. So I guess that's going to be standard on the new router.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
All right.
All right. Well, happy trails.
All right. I'm going to work on that. Thank you. All right. Let's go to Texas. Sterling, welcome.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing, Kevin?
Doing good. What can we help you with today?
Yeah, I have a dilemma. I quit my company job and ended up buying a 1994 cab over Freightliner. And it was an old movie truck that hauled lighting and stuff. So it's got a 28-foot box on it with a big lift gate. So I think what I'm looking at is maybe doing like some LTL freight or expediting freight with the truck, and I'm just trying to, I've come across a little dilemma because a gentleman has offered to give me a $21,000 profit if I sell the truck to him.
Okay.
And
how many miles are on it?
It's got 125,000 miles on a rebuilt 3406 E-Cat, 750,000 miles. On the truck.
See, it always bothers me a little bit when an engine's rebuilt that soon. Those engines were million miles plus, and they rebuilt it at 600 or 500 and some thousand. That always worries me a little bit. I don't mind old equipment if it's in good shape, but a 94 with that many miles. What did you pay for this?
I bought it for $7,000, and then I rebuilt the tranny and did some work to it.
How much
have you got? About 18 in it. I've got 18.
He's willing to pay you
39. Yeah.
All right. I would probably sell it. In fact, I'm almost positive I would sell it. That I don't know why he'd be willing to pay that much for this. But let me ask you this, though. You said you think you're going to do some LTL or some expediting. Have you do you have a lead on any of that kind of freight? LTL, do you mean local or?
Yeah, there's, this just kind of happened. I was actually taking care of my mom. I had to quit my job to take care of my mother, who's 80 years old. And I had bought this truck prior to that and just had plans of, I've got a couple leads on some companies where it's just shuttling some freight, but it's not a real good freight. I'd have to rely on load boards and things like that and probably get a little bit further away than I'd want to.
I can tell you're not going to find a whole lot for a 28-foot box on the load boards.
Right, right. That's what I'm running into.
Well,
plus the end of the truck.
Kind of what I was wondering, if you had very specific freight that this truck makes sense for, and it doesn't sound like you do.
I don't have that lined up right now, no.
Well, you may not be able to find it. That's the concern.
Right.
That isn't easy freight to find. LTL, yeah. Not only is it not easy to find it, it's really hard to manage it. And if you don't have any experience in that, it can be a disaster. Expediting is a whole different world. It's hard to expedite without a team. Because expedited freight needs to get there fast. That's the whole point. They don't want you taking your 10-hour break while their freight sits there. So, again, I would sell this thing. Even if you want to move forward with this business plan, there are better trucks out there than this one.
That's what it's not aerodynamic at all. And there's the only other option was household moving, which I have done that. It'd be real good for that.
Where are you going to get that work?
I would have to lease on with a company. And then I do have a couple contacts in that industry. So some private, smaller private companies that need moves done. They basically can't broker.
You really got the cart before the horse here.
I did. I bought the truck as a plan B, and all of a sudden it moved to A pretty quick.
Really what you need, if you want to be in business, you got to go find the work first. Now, look, if this was just over the road with a tractor, no big deal. That works all over the place. But it sounds to me like you're looking for more local. This is just a straight truck. That's a whole different world. And regionally, this changes a lot. That's what I'm saying. There's some parts where if you live, this truck would be almost worthless.
Right. Exactly. It's a very special – it's going to work for a niche market,
right.
Moving –
which is fine
product.
If you have that niche market, right now you don't, and it may not exist where you are. So I would sell this thing and start over and work on your business model before you buy anything.
Yeah, put the horse in front of the cart. Got
yeah.
It.
Yeah. Okay. But you know, it worked out great. You're going to make $21,000 on this. Congratulations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a really clean truck and all kinds of – the guy's getting a good truck too, but he runs older equipment, and he apparently has a niche for it. So.
Yeah, and you know, maybe since you already own the truck, maybe really work hard on seeing if there is freight in your area that's going to make sense with this truck. Shouldn't take you that long, a week or two of really going out, beating on some doors and checking some things. And maybe you do put together some freight and this truck makes sense and you already have it.
And right. The other option, one option I was looking at was I could pull the box off of it and put a fifth wheel on it too.
And then what kind of freight are you going to go pull?
Well, then I'd just be pulling regular. I could hook up to any trailer.
Right. You're mostly going to be over the road. Local freight as an owner-operator is tough to find in a lot of places.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I'm running into.
I've been knocking on some doors.
You have to really put something together.
You've got a fairly expensive modification. You can't just pull the box off. You've got to cut the frame and move all the drive line.
It's weird on these cab overs. They love them. The longer the frame, the better. And then they... actually bring more money than I'm asking for the truck.
I'm not talking about selling it. I'm talking about building an efficient truck. And the last thing you want is a big, long frame that puts your trailer way behind you. Kills your aerodynamics.
Oh, I agree. No, it doesn't make sense.
And it's difficult to get into places with the long wheelbase.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I've never understood the point of the big stretched out frames.
I see them hauling cattle trailers. It's really weird. It doesn't make sense, but I guess some guys like it.
It makes no sense whatsoever. There's no good reason to do it. It makes the vehicle far less efficient, less maneuverable. It's an image thing is all it is.
Yeah, it's to be different, I guess.
I'm just not into creating an image in my business that nobody cares about. None of your customers could care less about any of that stuff.
I agree.
All of that stuff on a truck. And look, if people want to do this, it's up to them. I'm not telling anybody not to. But ego thing. The chrome, the hoods, the stretched out frames, it's all just an ego. Could care less.
That's an expensive ego.
Well, it is. It really is. But people want to do it and they can afford it. Knock yourself out. I just don't look at business that way. That's an awful lot of profit to lose year after year after year for looking good in somebody's eyes. Most people just don't care.
Okay. Well, I think you answered my question. I knew that it's really not. You can't even get your pants on in the morning in a cab over flat top.
I kind of love cab overs, but it's not really. There's a lot of reasons this truck doesn't seem practical to me. Like I said, you may want to take a week or two, see if you can put together some freight that makes sense for this thing. If not, I would take that offer and run.
I think that's some sage advice. I very much appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Tennessee. Patrick, welcome.
Morning.
What's on your mind today?
So, you're right about that truck. It's just not conducive to a decent operation. I mean, if that was my truck, I'd have just taken the $39,000 and said, okay, here's keys, bye. Right? Because it's not a good fit.
It could turn into one of those happy mistakes. I mean, he made a mistake buying this. It was just not. There was no good reason to buy this truck. But when you can profit $21,000, that's a pretty happy mistake.
Yep, that's right. So I got two things. I got one thing for Leroy, and I wish he could explain it to me. So one of our Toon customers out of Montana on Saturday, he was out in Iowa with his brand new 24 X15 and a 389 Pete. Great truck, great looking truck, all that stuff. His ambient air temperature sensor in the left-hand mirror went tits up. So, and the truck's under warranty, not that big of a deal. So he got it into a place here in Cedar Rapids, Peterbilt dealership yesterday, got it all squared away. And like I said, it was under warranty, but it went to derate this truck. And when Steve's telling me that, I'm sitting there going, what? You know, so how much stuff is that ambient air temperature? And maybe you don't know, Leroy, I don't know. But how much stuff and why would that ambient air temperature be hooked to anything in the ECM that would derate it?
Well, so the ambient condition is one of the biggest, like, dictators of how that engine works, because it doesn't work off of, like, a boost number or anything like that. It works off of, like, a mass airflow number. And in order to know how much air, what the air density is, you have to know what the air temperature is. So when that part of the system breaks down, the ambient air temperature system breaks down, it has no idea how dense the air is. So if that doesn't know that, it doesn't know what boost maps to use. It doesn't know what fueling maps to use. It gets they get that system all up in a fit when that thing breaks.
Oh, it pissed this thing off. He called me and he goes, I don't know what the hell happened, but this thing wants to derate in 236 minutes. And I just couldn't wrap my head around it, which is fine. I'm not the guru. I'm just the guy that hooks the computer up. So I get that part of it. But the problem is, why wouldn't they, in my opinion or my eyes anyway, why wouldn't they or why couldn't they not put that in the mirror? Why wouldn't they put that somewhere else in the truck or on the truck? Because we all know that out there on the mirror when it's icy and crappy weather and those kind of things, that's probably the first thing to ice over. So why would they use that in conjunction with, and I get what you're saying, I'm not trying to argue with you, but why wouldn't they take that reading somewhere else in the engine? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know on Freightliners, I believe, that they have their ambient air temperature sensor up by, like, the charge air cooler. Like, it's right out front. You want the best representation of ambient conditions. Typically, that's on the outside, not anywhere under the hood, because it's usually a little warmer under the hood. But there are better places to put it than in the mirror. I agree with you there. I mean, I see mirror issues all the time, but I would really wonder if you could just relocate that sensor to somewhere like by the grill or something that sort of hides behind the grill. I mean, it's the first thing that gets damaged when if you hit something, but I guess the same thing goes for the mirror. You could knock the mirror off. So.
But couldn't you put it between the charge air cooler and the condenser, and wouldn't that make a little more sense? It would still get the airflow, but it wouldn't maybe be so subjective to getting damaged.
Yeah, that's kind of where Freightliners have it. Don't want it where, like, air is blowing over it. You just want it to kind of receive ambient conditions. You don't want, like, the cooling effect of wind going over it. But somewhere up front, I think, is a much better place than in the mirror.
So, like, on the side mount or something, you could put that thing standing up or down or whatever you needed to do, zip tie it there and be done with it.
Yeah, there's a couple of places you can put it, yeah.
And then... And then we had a customer that had a 15 389 with a Cummins in it, ISX. We tuned him up. He was just happier than he could be with that truck. And then it started giving him troubles. I mean, every time he turned around, it was after treatment, after treatment, after treatment. And he just got sick of it. So he got an offer for the engine from a fleet, and it was like, $40,000 for this engine. It was stupid because he wanted to figure out something different to put in the truck. So he took the $40,000. They pulled that engine out of the truck. He went and got a 12.7 Detroit, brand new in the box, brought it to us after he got it in the truck. We tuned it up. He was out in California pulling Tesla batteries, those great big ones, oversized loads, like 80-some thousand pounds net. On six axles, which I still don't know how California gave him a permit for that, but apparently they did. But he's going down the road here about a month ago, and the oil return on the turbo started pissing oil and caught his engine on fire and burnt his truck to the ground. Everything from the headache rack forward was gone.
All right.
And go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just making a joke. Go ahead.
So, you know, three or four fire extinguishers later, it still burnt to the ground. He just went out and found another truck. And what I'm getting at is you guys delete or you guys, you know, do whatever fine. To make sure that, you know, maybe you don't have to do the after treatment, which, in my opinion, it doesn't matter. But remember, there can always be worse problems down the road. Everybody, you know, a lot of folks talk about deleting, and I try to talk them out of that because of what we can do as Pittsburgh Power, especially with the high-altitude stuff that we do in Cheyenne. And at the end of the day, this young man, 30 years old, is going through a lot of PTSD I mean, that was his whole life that went up in smoke and flames. And you don't realize it. I suppose it would be kind of like losing your spouse or what have you, but it's an issue, and it's and you know, if you lost somebody in an accident or something, I suppose that would be PTSD like. And this poor young man is going through a lot of PTSD right now, and I'm trying to help him through that, but it's really tough. And you don't realize the decisions you make today could affect you 60, 90, 100, 200 days down the road and lead into these things. And I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but it's a big thing when you don't. And I don't know if he was checking these things or if that's a common problem with the Detroits. I don't know. But, you know, going down the road and your truck burst into flames, that's pretty serious deal. So
yeah.
his life went up in flames, you know, for lack of a better term. So.
Yeah. I get it. All right.
Kevin, is that kind of a typical thing on these Detroits where, and it didn't look like anything was rubbing. It looks like it just came loose off of the turbo return.
First I've heard of it. Anybody else?
It's not a known problem.
I'm aware of.
The way they're designed, they don't seem to break or crack. I mean, sometimes we get small leaks out of them, but I've never had one leak that bad that it ran out of oil, but. You know, the tube could have cracked. Maybe the bolts weren't tight. It's hard to say what exactly happened. And once it catches fire, it's going to be pretty tough to determine what actually happened.
Right. No, and I agree with that, Pete. You're right. So, but,
yeah.
All right.
Something
all right, guys. That's all I got.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's Oklahoma. Paul, welcome.
Howdy.
What's on your mind today?
The guy with that cab over. Take the money and run.
That seems to be the consent.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So, but he talked about taking the body off. I have seen one good use of those stretched out cab overs, and that's the guys that haul 70-foot I-beams, steel I-beams. There's a 53-foot trailer, and they're hanging off the front, and they're hanging off the back. Well, if you got a 300-inch wheelbase cab over, you can have a lot of steel hanging off the front of the trailer before you're up to the back of the cab. So that's about the only practical use I see for that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's pretty limited.
Yeah. So I do have a question for Leroy. On the new Peterbilts with the digital dash, so I know a guy who's contemplating buying a new truck, and he's a diehard pre-emission guy, and he's talking about yanking that Cummins out of it and dropping a pre-emission Caterpillar in there. Is he going to be able to make that engine? He don't care about emission rules or anything. Is he going to be able to make that dashboard talk to that engine or vice versa, or is he up shit creek?
I mean, I don't know for sure. My conjecture would be if it has 1939, it might read like tachometer and coolant temp and things like that. But I also think that it's going to miss the engine that it was programmed to look at. So it's probably just going to lose its marbles. And it may work, it may not. If I had to put money on it, I would say it's not going to work.
Yeah, well, he did talk to the people out there in Coos Bay, Oregon, and they said it'd probably be a year before they even can work anything out to make it work. So, yeah, but...
Yeah, you're almost better off to try to get, like, individual gauges, like, out of, like, the old Peterbilts, and then just, like, wire them individually and just make your own dash. That's, if you're going to that much of the extent where you're cutting the truck up and putting a different engine in it anyway, I would just put the dash up.
Okay, you could go to a recycling yard and find one that's been totaled, but the dash was good.
Yeah, like a 2015 389, something like that. Those had like individual clusters. You could take that out,
okay,
and put it on your own sort of plastic panel, and then just wire them together. That's what I would do.
Okay, I'll let him know. But because when he talked about it, I said, you might not be able to make that engine and the dashboard communicate, so you might be driving just totally by feel. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
if it vibrates down.
So I'm on. Yeah. if you're in the left lane and passing everybody, you're probably going too fast. So.
Yeah.
So I'm about 8,000 miles short of the same amount of miles that was on my engine when it was rebuilt up there at Pittsburgh Power. So within a couple of weeks, I should be
ready for another
match
rebuild.
No, not even close this time. So.
Well, but, there you go. Yeah. Built right this time.
Yeah, I do put a little bit of oil in it occasionally, but when I took it up there in 2018 at 639,000 miles, on average, I was tipping 5 gallons of oil a month in it. So, yeah,
wow.
It's a whole lot better engine than it was to start with. So.
Sure is. Uh-oh. I think we lost Paul. He disappeared. We got one more call in the screening room. We'll grab that here in a couple minutes. Probably will be the last call for today. I need to get on with some things. So while we're waiting, anybody have anything they want to mention?
Nope, I do not.
No. All right. We'll just we'll have a little sing-along then while we're waiting. Who wants to lead?
Leroy can lead.
Okay. Come on in. You hurry up. Save us here. There we go. We can go to Wisconsin now and talk to Nick. Nick, aww. Welcome.
Hey, guys. That call, Paul called in. Did he say his buddy wanted to put a cat in a new Pete? Is that what he's doing?
Yes.
Okay. There's a company in Nebraska called Elkhorn Valley Trucks. They do just that. But I will say, I think they tried doing it with one of the new digital dash Peterbilts, and it was a disaster. They'd been doing it with the older style dashes, and Nebraska has kind of a loophole where you can do something like that, and they give you a whole new title for the truck, and that way you're not in trouble with emissions. But yeah, as far as the digital dash, they ran into trouble.
Let me ask you something. What regulation are they using to put a non-emission engine in an emission truck?
So if you replace a major component in a vehicle, they give you what's called an assembled title, and such as a cab or an engine. So that's the loophole they found. They've been doing it for years. If you go to their website, they've got plenty of them in inventory. Now, I don't know, maybe somebody could get caught and get in trouble, but my understanding is it's a legit process.
I'd love to see, first off, it's not that big of a deal because the cost of this is usually way out of whack. I mean, it very seldom ever makes sense to do this. I guess if you've got a newer truck with a, you know, motor gone, maybe then. But even then, the additional cost to go back to an older technology engine when the new ones are doing fine, the whole process doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. If anybody's interested in it, I would be concerned. I don't believe you're allowed to do this based on emission regulations because why wouldn't everybody do it? I mean, they even shut down the glider loophole, but this wouldn't even apply as a glider. So I if anybody's doing this, I would just be careful. Awful lot of money and end up with a non-compliant truck. But to me,
they've been doing it for quite a while. They actually were ordering brand new trucks right from Peterbilt and taking them up there, jerking the Cummins out, selling the Cummins motor, putting a cat in it, and selling them for a profit. So
Deletes have been going on for 15 plus years, and people are just now being prosecuted for it.
Right.
That's been we've been going on since the mid 2000s, and there isn't a week that goes by anymore that I don't see some shop being dinged for this.
Yeah.
I would just be careful with that. And like I said, the whole process doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Well, I don't know. You see a lot of Cummins with the trucks for sale that have been rebuilt after 300,000 or 400,000 miles. So,
well, the answer
is that
don't buy the Cummins. But yeah. what's an average cost? Does anybody know? I mean, if I bring in a new modern truck and I want an older engine put into it, what's it going to cost me?
I don't know. I know they were selling the trucks, the new trucks, for about what you could, I don't know how, but for about what you're paying for them from Peterbilt now, like
$230,000. Oh, man, no way.
I mean, that's what a new 389 new costs, like $240 now, $250.
I know, but new, I've got a new modern engine. And I can't imagine spending $230,000 on a truck that's been modified this heavily, has an older engine, and might not even be legal. Whew. All right.
You know, out there in the Midwest, they don't really police that stuff too much, so I guess maybe that's what they're docking on. I don't know.
Well, like I said, for the last 15 years, nobody's enforced anything anywhere. We've talked about this the whole time, that people are getting away with all kinds of stuff until they're not. And now all of a sudden I see, and I don't see it being geographical. I've seen them crack down on shops all over the country.
It might be a thing, too, where they're like building a case and it takes a while. You know, you have to sort of have multiple things happen. You want to make this fish as big as possible before you poach it.
Yeah.
They might be just racking cases and having an absolute bulletproof case before they take it to court so that there's no way to get around it. They might be doing that. They might be on the watch list. You never know.
Hey, Kevin, I'm looking at their website. They have a 2024 389 Pete flat top with, so what it says is with assembled title, very similar to a glider title.
And how much?
It doesn't give a price, but it has a 550 cat. Oh, $229,000.
I wonder what those things go for new, because you have to buy the truck with the engine, rip the engine out, buy another engine.
You'd have to
rebuild it.
Or just buy a cat reman engine, which is four.
Can you buy one?
You'd have to pay a core charge. That's another $10,000.
So you're paying $55,000 on top of a new truck and then labor to install all that. I just don't know how you make any money doing that.
They would have the engine to sell.
Well,
then, buy it.
Yeah. Well, here's the other thing. If they can, you're telling me you pay $230,000 for a new Cat or a new Peterbilt or Kenworth now, if that's the regular price, then nothing about this makes sense. They would have to be able to buy their trucks at like $160,000 or $50,000, and they'd still have really small profit margins. So if they can buy a new one at $150,000, why can't I?
Yeah. Yeah, they're better off just to buy the new trucks and then resell them if they can get a good deal.
Make any sense to me at all. And the numbers don't even work.
Gets to me.
Yeah, they've got to have $60,000 into that conversion. I just don't know how you could do it for much less than that. So that means we're paying $60,000 above what the new truck cost originally, or more. Yeah, I don't know.
What can you get for an X15 that's brand new?
Wait, so a reman engine is probably well in the 40s. I mean, there is value there. It's just a matter of finding someone that would need a newer engine.
Who has an X15 2450, which is only like a 22 or 23 and newer truck that's blown up? I mean, those happen, but
generally they're under warranty.
Yeah.
It's not a big market.
Right. Not a big market. All those.
So I Googled what is an assembled title. And it says, an assembled title is given to a vehicle that was built or assembled by an individual or business that is not a major car manufacturer.
Okay, so that does nothing to alleviate the emission requirement on that year of a vehicle.
Correct.
But wait a minute. Hold on. Wait a minute. What about like these Shelby Cobras? They're doing the same exact thing today. It's an assembled kit. There's no emissions requirements. Same exact story. And they're getting away with it.
They might be. I'm not going to argue the law. I just, nothing about this whole process makes any sense to me.
I, I think the key is the word assembled. I think there's a loophole with the EPA or whatever, because they've been doing those cars for shit ever since 70s probably.
That just feels like a loophole that they can close at any point if they wanted to. If they found out like everyone's doing this, like,
oh, okay, cool.
I'm not,
but I don't think, but I don't think they can take a vehicle off the road for it. If it's legal as it is now.
That's still the question I have. Is this a real loophole that's legal, or is it just that nobody's been prosecuted for it yet because it's not that common, because the numbers don't make sense?
They don't make sense to us, but apparently he's figured out a way to do it to make money because he's been doing it for years.
Well, if he's making money, that's fine. That's not the business I'm going into. I'm trying to help people make sure they buy a smart truck. And this does not make any sense to me in any way.
And I think another problem would be if you brought that truck to a lot of shops, I think they would refuse to work on it. You think so?
I think so. They're not going to know the law, but they're going to look at a brand new truck and go, wait a minute, this thing has all kinds of emission requirements and we've got an old engine in it. And they're not going to know the law any better than the rest of us. So you're right. You're going to have a hard time selling it. If that ever becomes an issue, you're going to have a hard time getting it worked on. I just, I can't see any reason to do this. I see none.
It'd be almost like selling a vehicle with a reconstructed title as far as I'm concerned, because it says here the certificate of title will have the words assembled vehicle printed on the face of the title.
Right, which I will promise you, if I'm running a rig dig and I see that, I'm moving on. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to take a chance on something like that. That's the first time I've looked at title issues.
Yeah. Does insurance companies care about that?
Probably not. I don't know, because they are going to see the title. That's right. I was going to say they wouldn't even know, but they will because of the title brand that's on there. I still am not convinced that just by calling this an assembled vehicle, we just eliminate all of the emission requirements.
I agree. You know, like you said, they cracked down on the gliders. They eliminated that.
Right. Right. And gliders were a legal loophole that they took away. They went in and changed the law to take that one away. That was a legal loophole to get around emissions, and everybody knew that. But I have never seen this as legal, to just change an engine in a vehicle and say, well, it's an assembled vehicle, and I don't have to meet emission requirements. I've just never seen that.
Well, we need to do some more research and look into this. I can't imagine
you
that.
Start assembling vehicles?
No, I can't imagine it's legal, but I'd like to know the answer.
Yeah, I would, too. I would, too. Yeah. Not that it's really going to end up on my radar because a lot of other reasons, but I still have a feeling this is illegal. We'll see. We'll check. Nick, anything else?
Yeah, actually, the reason why I called, products such as Motor Coat that are allegedly supposed to go in there and put some friction modifier on your internal parts of your engine or drivetrain. Anybody have any thoughts on those things? Are they BS?
I do. You know, we've been through some changes on fuel additives. I've changed my mind a little bit over the years on fuel additives, and there are some benefits to them. I see none in oil, and I just see problems. There's been way too many oil additives over the years that have caused problems. There are no friction modifiers that any engine manufacturer couldn't put in themselves. They already do. They use MOLLE. They use all kinds of things as friction modifiers. So to take another chemical and dump it into a bunch of oils that all have different formulations, I've just never been wild about that. And I've never seen any results.
Yeah.
I mean, I
talk to some guys that they're running it, and they see lower temperatures in their rear end. But I don't know. To me, if you're coating the metal with something, the oil may not stick to it as well. And you know,
now to put it into a transmission or a differential doesn't bother me as much because we don't have all the additives in those. They're not complicated formulations of additives the way an engine is. because an engine, we've got combustion gases to take care of. These other components are sealed. The oil doesn't get contaminated. It doesn't have a lot of additives already. I'd be shocked if somebody could actually show me a significant temperature or any temperature drop at all. But that would be easy enough to prove. I mean, that would be a simple test. Check your temperature, you know, 10 times to get a good average. Change or add that, check 10 more times and show me the results, and I'll say, okay, something's happening in there. I still wouldn't want it in an engine. The engine is far more complicated when it comes to the oil, and I can't imagine you're going to get much less friction than today's full synthetic 10W30s.
We're not seeing oil-related failures. I mean, if a truck spun a bearing, it was dirt ingestion or fuel in the oil. Seldom does a engine have a failure when everything's right. And we just don't. The oils have gotten better. Filtration's gotten better. We have the OPS out there to keep the oil even cleaner. I don't see a need for any type of additive like that because these engines are going a million miles and people are going 100,000 miles on oil changes.
And if somebody's going to claim that because they put this in an engine, they've got better fuel economy, I would have to see some serious documentation proving that.
Yeah, and my thought was if it lowers the temperature in like your rear ends and even the engine, that actually might be a bad thing because I know mine, I don't get very good mileage until everything warms up. You got to get some temperature and all that stuff.
You bring up a good point. Do we want to lower temperatures in components? I mean, a lot of these components are like they're not failing because of heat. So why do we want to lower temperature in them?
It's just been an old train of thought. The lower the temperature, the better. But we're finding out that it's less efficient that way.
And there was a time where maybe that made sense. When we didn't have the kind of machining processes we have now, components weren't lasting as long. Maybe if you reduced heat, there was some benefit to it. But I doubt that there's any benefit today. In fact, it could be a negative. But I kind of doubt that you're ever going to see any real measurable difference. Like I say, I can almost guarantee you're not going to see a fuel mileage increase. All right, we are going to wrap this up for today. Tomorrow on Destination Health, we have a new guest joining us, Dr. Keith Smidgel from the Natural Heart Doctor. He is one of the new team members at Dr. Wolfson. So we will we'll be talking to him tomorrow. Thursday, I believe we are doing an episode of Trucking Technology and Efficiency because Friday I'm going to be off doing some training. And I think we're actually having John Walco join us on Thursday. John will be back after a long absence, so we're looking forward to that. All right, we will see you then. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey.